My name is Mike, and this is The Goods. You're listening to Episode 9, Part 4. In this series, we deconstruct how Herman Demick prepared for the Spartan Games in just 72 hours. If you're just joining us, we're picking up the story on Day 3 with Event 1. So Day 2 ended with Event 5, which was the Laruda Mountain Bike Challenge. It was 5 hours to record as many laps as possible over a 9-mile, 1,500-foot elevation course. You mentioned before that it was described as like rolling hills and non-technical. What was the mountain trail actually like?
So if I could describe it to most people, again, to a super advanced rider, sure, it's probably not terrible. The climb actually wasn't terrible. The climb itself, yeah, sure, it was a little difficult. You had some switchbacks. You had to hop off your bike and jump over some trees, and you had to hold your bike on your shoulder and climb up some rocks to get to some spots. But ultimately, the climb was more of a grind. It wasn't necessarily miserable. If you're a skier or if you're a mountain biker, it's probably a blue climb. On the way down, it's probably a black diamond descent. It's not like a triple black. There was somewhat of a path, but I mean, you're talking in some instances having to get through creeks directly at the bottom of an 8-foot fall, and you're on the edge of a cliff is the wrong word, but if you fall off the side of this 2 or 3 foot wide trail, you're going to fall down the hill 20 or 30 feet into trees. Is it the most difficult course on the planet? No, without question, it wasn't. But the way it was described to us, rolling and non-technical means it's going to come more down to work capacity than it is the technicality of actually riding a bike. And surprise, I've never done any mountain biking before. I don't even own a mountain bike. So that's the whole point of this particular event. Everybody knew that they were going. They called me 72 hours before and they're like, hey, here are the numbers. Here are the places you can rent a mountain bike from. Go ahead and reserve yourself a bike. It's in October in Vermont when people come from all over the world, like peak season, to come do that. There's no way there's anything available. So I call every bike store in like 100-mile radius and they don't have a single bike left. So I'm like, what am I going to do? And no one had one up there that I was aware of. So my wife happens to have a stump jumper. It's a full carbon front suspension, hardtail. It's a great bike. You know, it's probably a 2011, 12. You're talking a 9-10-year-old bike, something like that. But it's still a great bike. So she's like, well, here, you could just take mine. And again, me being a newbie, not knowing anything, we didn't realize that the front fork was seized. Oof. We had no idea that the brakes were already blown because it hadn't been ridden in so long. So I pack it up, take it up there with me, and then pull it out. And I'm like, why do these shocks not work?
Oh,
I'm
no.
Like, ah, whatever. I'm like, and in my head, I'm thinking, ah, it's rolling, non-technical. Maybe it'll help me be faster because if you don't have that give in the bike, you can be like, okay, cool. So then I pump the tires up a little bit more. I'm preparing to be able to try and go fast. That ain't happening. So I start pedaling and my back wheels are spinning out and trying to get up the hills and do this. So the first 20 miles and 6,000 feet of elevation changes, because you said, I think it's 1,500 up, 1,500 down times 2 laps. And each lap is approximately 10 miles. I went on 0 shocks and just completely wore it. You should have just put me on a vibration plate. I was wearing every root, every rock the whole way. And I finally get to the point to where I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And they ended up having one loaner bike that a bike store ended up last minute donating and having there. So I, in the middle of the race, had to hop off. We had to try and take my pedals off, which, by the way, my pedals, because they had been in there for so long, had rusted themselves in. So it took 20, 30 minutes to try and pull my pedals out, change cleats, get the shoes back to fit. And I rode another, I think it's a Jamis hotline. And I rode the next 2 laps on that one. And I'm like, this is what a great bike is like. Holy moly. Now I know how good certain mountain bikes can be. It was a whole new ball game. And my next 2 laps were probably, it's got to be an hour faster than my first two. Like, man, if I would have just hopped on this bike to begin with, my place would have been completely different on that event. Because I think that event was my worst place.
I think you're right. You finished that event in ninth, but you stayed in third overall to close out day two, followed by Ryan Kent. How did your body feel? Like, you'd done two pretty hard events in that day, and you've just done this mountain bike ride where you'd basically absorbed every vibration and rock and route on the trail. How did you feel then? Did your body feel beaten up, or were you ready to go again?
So I did not feel beaten up. I knew fatigue was starting to set in, just because that's a lot of work volume to happen in 2 days.
Yeah.
And I'd also say that not only is it a lot of physical work volume, but people a lot of times forget about the adrenal fatigue that comes from having to be so on it mentally, because especially when you're having to take those beatings, you have to mentally try and stay focused for the next route, for the next rock, for the next something, because when you're not comfortable with whatever it is that you're doing, your alertness and your nervous system has to be extra on edge to make sure you don't make a mistake and get yourself hurt. So that I wasn't just noticing the physical fatigue. It was literally just saying, okay, all right, we got to remain in survival mode and be tactically smart with how you approach everything. So I could tell physical fatigue, but probably more a little mental fatigue at that point.
And was there anything that you were using to focus on recovery, particularly for like your central nervous system and your adrenals?
So I use Thorn Research. I use their products. They have an adrenal cortex supplement that's got a little bit of licorice root and some bovine like adrenal peptides that are in it, just to help maintain some of that adrenal response. And then the other thing that really has kept me where I need to be from a cognitive perspective, a focus perspective, has been drinking my exogenous ketones. So I actually am able to put myself into a state of ketosis, whether I actually eat keto or not, or whether or not I'm super depleted and eat really low carbohydrate. So I still get the benefits of being in ketosis without having to eat that way. I can still eat for performance and then drink my ketones so that I can spare my muscle glycogen for as long as possible.
And is that why ketones are important at this point, to replace the muscle glycogen?
It's not necessarily that it replaces it. So you still want to then eat your carbohydrates to replace that muscle glycogen, eat your protein to kind of repair some of the damaged tissue. But people don't realize this. Exogenous ketones are widely even used in the cycling world and ultra endurance distance, because it can act as an energy source and act as muscle preservation and glycogen sparing. So really, it'll help your body use ketone as an energy source. That's been a key for me, because my training has been so little, but it's allowed me to preserve my muscle mass and some of my physicality, even when I'm not training as much and when I'm in a caloric deficit. I personally use a product made by the company Prove It, Pruvit. They've got a number of patents on their products that helps separate them from the rest of the market.
Interesting. Moving on to day three, it kicked off with something I think the athletes were a little bit taken by surprise. There was a Spartan wrestling event. Can you tell us a bit about how that was announced and how the reaction was amongst the athletes?
People were super excited, super nervous, and I think it did catch a couple people initially off guard. And I'll say that because, number one, some people I think were a little scared. Heck, you no longer have a weight class. Like, you're now, they're going to put us in and have us wrestle, and it doesn't matter how heavy or how light you are, we're all going to be against each other. You've got Kurt Majit, who's 240 pounds at 6% body fat. He's strong. He played in the NFL, you know, but then there's also guys like Mike Wardian, who's an ultra and distance marathon runner, who's probably one of the most amazing human beings I've ever met, but he's, I don't know, give it 150 pounds. Aaron Newell, a smaller guy, but a great athlete, a great runner. And then you're going to put these guys against each other. Like, it's just not the same. And some of the girls that are competing, Faith, who's super strong, and there are girls that are ultra endurance. We're talking Kellen Taylor. So Kellen, who's the seventh fastest marathoner in U.S. history, she runs a 430 mile, and she's run a 224 marathon. That's like a 520 or a 530 pace for 26.2 miles. And then you're going against Faith, somebody who's a weightlifter, who's super strong, and you're going to put them against each other. Like, I think that scared a lot of people. And a lot of these people also have professional careers away from the Spartan events. So it scared them to think, oh man, what if I get hurt doing this and I can't go make a living? Or what if my sponsor drops me because maybe I get a broken foot, or I do something that I shouldn't do just because I'm trying to win a Spartan Games?
And what were the rules? Because this was on a circular sand pit in an outdoor part of the farm there. It wasn't set by body weight, as you've just described. How did you secure a win?
Every match was one 90-second round, or it was the first to 5 points. And you could earn a point by pushing your opponent out of the sand pit, or by making your opponent put anything other than the bottoms of their feet on the ground. So hand and elbow, a knee, if you are pushing somebody and their feet slip out from underneath them and their knee touches, you get a point. So it was, they tried to make this as safe as they could possibly do it, but there was nothing like jujitsu. Like, you're not rolling on the ground. As soon as somebody touches the ground, that point is over. And it's either whoever has 5 points first or whoever has the most points at the end of 90 seconds.
Wow. Who out of all the men's field was your most challenging opponent? Like you mentioned, there's Kurt at about 240 pounds. You've got Hunter, you've got Ryan Atkins, you've got Ryan Kent, Aaron Newell, all these different diverse athletes from all these different backgrounds. Who'd you go up against and face the biggest challenge from?
So they had two different brackets, and just luck of the draw and based on where I was currently placed. So going into that event or that day, I'm still in third. In order to create the brackets, the top four got a first round bye. So I got a first round bye, which is great, while everybody else had to go through. And then it just so happened, the way it played out, that I was put in the heavyweight bracket. Like, it wasn't meant to be that way. But the other three people that were in my bracket was Kurt Majette, Hunter McIntyre, and the man, the myth, the legend himself, Island Ninja, Grant McCartney. So it's those three guys, and they're all in excess of 200 pounds. And they're big guys. It ended up being, I got my first round bye. Then I got Aaron Newell. I was able to get a win against Aaron. And then my very next one is against Hunter McIntyre. And what people don't know is Hunter McIntyre actually grew up in high school and in college as a wrestler. So he's got a lot of experience. He's a very strong, athletic person with wrestling background. He got the first point. And then I got the next point because he tries to do something. I slip around the back of him and I lift him up and we both kind of fall on each other, and he gets angry that I got the point. And the last thing you want, right, is a big, strong, heavy guy angry at you. The very next point, he throws me around like a rag doll and I'm laying on my stomach and I'm trying to get up, and he pushes me in the back and pushes my face back down into the sand. But again, like, he wants to get underneath people's skin. And I just let it go. I didn't say anything about it. And of course, he ends up winning. Like, I didn't plan on winning that. And my next one is against Kurt, right? So I go directly from him into Kurt. And it didn't matter what I do. Those guys are big. And Kurt, also being a football guy, is very good with his hands. So it doesn't really matter what you try and do. He's good with it. So I lost both of those. And I would say both Kurt and Hunter, they were equally as difficult because they're both heavy, they're both strong, and they're both technically proficient.
Yeah. And how did you use your background in strength and conditioning to your advantage in this event? Because you've indicated that the stronger athletes were more favorable in this type of event. Was there anything that you did or recall doing that helped you through the wrestling event?
No, because again, in that one, I got a bye. I was able to secure a win, and then I lost my next two. So I was not going to say my strength and conditioning background. And what made it hard was anytime you put somebody on sand, you take away some of their athleticism. And that's why you look at like rugby games, you look at soccer games, you look at football games. In the very bad weather, the fast teams can no longer rely on just being fast. It's now just strength, because now you have to be able to just push forward and back. And I'm pretty fast. And that was taken away from me. So I actually felt like that actually kind of hurt me in that instance.
Yeah, like a little slower than you typically would be. And is that just the surface being, you know, soft and pliable under your feet and not being something that you can necessarily predict?
Yeah. And at that point, it was cold that morning too. Like people were freezing that morning and you're trying to move around, you know, without a shirt on. Because the last thing you want is to give somebody something extra to grab to swing you around with.
You tied for fifth, moving into the 6-hour Spartan trail run. What do you say to yourself over 6 hours on the trail running, like just to stay focused and in tune? Is there anything that you say to yourself to keep going?
No, I think you just have to remind yourself why you're there. And there was a lot of individual time to think, you know, on that particular event. I probably ran with Hunter for an hour or two of that particular one. The first lap was with Ryan Kent, and then Hunter and I ended up meeting up at some point. And this is where I'm going to take up for Hunter and say, he's a good guy. He knows how to compete and get underneath people's skin. And he's going to say what's on his mind, and he's going to do a lot of things that are going to help him get some social media followers and get marketing and use things to his advantage on top of being an amazing athlete. But when we were on our run, he's like, you know what, Herm, I want you to know, he's like, I'm sorry I pushed you when we were wrestling. And I was like, it's no big deal. I understand where it was coming from. We are going back as primal as we can get. Testosterone starts flying. You know, I was super impressed that he took the time even to just acknowledge that it happened. He's a good guy. He doesn't always get the best reputation because of who he is when the lights turn on, but people don't realize that he'll invite a lot of people over to his house just to go train or just to live or do whatever. I mean, he's got his competition personality when the lights turn on, and he's going to do everything he can to win no matter what. And then you've got his personality away from that when the cameras aren't always on, when he's a genuine human being.
Sounds like he's able to like flip a switch and become an extreme competitor quite easily. But when the lights go down, he's a really genuine, good guy to be around.
Yeah.
At the end of day three, you dropped to fifth with 72 points, 2 points out of fourth and 8 points out of third. What are you feeling at this point in the competition with all that had come before?
I think there's a little bit of gamesmanship that was going on in that run that people don't realize. So I actually finished my fourth lap, my 20th mile, a little under 4 hours. I want to say it was a little under 4 hours. And I was in seventh or eighth, something like that. And there was no one within 30, 40 minutes of me at that point. So I'm thinking to myself, is it worth it to run another 5 miles through another 2,000 feet of elevation change, or should I just sit back and see what happens? And some people start crossing. I take my shoes off. I go inside. I get some of my ketones. I throw some ketones back, eat some gummies, and just sit and hang out for a little bit, because there's no reason for me to take another lap if it's not going to earn me any points. Kellen Taylor actually finished her 20 miles faster than everyone else. Wasn't even close. But she said, okay, I'm done, and stopped and just walked away and let everybody else continue to run. And then Grant McCartney comes in at like 4 hours and 35 minutes of the 6 hours. And his last lap was right around an hour and 15. So technically, if he can match that lap again, he can get one more lap. But if he does that other lap and completes it, because you don't get credit unless you actually complete the full lap.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you could technically run 4.9 miles. And if the time expires, that 4.9 miles that you ran was all for nothing. So I was sitting there thinking, okay, maybe he'll just say, nah, I'm done. Well, he literally just said, okay, well, I told myself if I was coming here, if it was time to race, it was time to race. If it's time to rest, it's time to rest. I've got an hour and 25 minutes left. And I did my last lap in an hour and 15 minutes. All right, I'm going. Here we go. I didn't even have my shoes on at this point. All of a sudden, he's like, all right, here we go. So I quickly go run, grab my shoes, lace them up, and I take off. And I'm still playing a little bit of gamesmanship here. So I take off and I'm like, I don't care what happens. If I'm going to run this last lap, there ain't no way he's going to catch me. I'm not going to let this happen. And I take off and we start getting 3/4 of a mile to a mile up the mountain. And I'll stop and I'll hide behind a tree. And I would wait for a couple minutes. And all of a sudden I'd see his flowing hair in the back and I'd hear the leaves cracking. And I'm like, all right, somebody's coming. Is it him? And then I'll see it. I'm like, all right, cool. And then I'll take off again. And I'd go run another half mile because what I didn't want to have happen was have him play that game on me and have him pretend like he's going to go, let me get way in front of him, and then not run it. So by the time we get to the top of the mountain and I see him coming up the hill, it doesn't matter now. It's like, how far can you get in the woods? It's halfway. Because once you get halfway, you're going out the other side. So by the time I get to the top of the mountain, we both have to go down. So I just cut it loose and I head down the mountain. And that final lap was like just under 50 minutes with some stops to see if he was coming. So I knew like that I ran a PR last lap from mile 21 to 25. So I know I had it, but if I can foreshadow anything at this point in our conversation, it's that final 5 miles wrecked me for the rest of the competition.
That might be an interesting segue point into day 4, which opened with the Spartan Extreme Endurance Vertical 300, which essentially is running 300 meters in a weighted vest to the top of that same mountain. After running that 6 hours the day before, you said that you were feeling rubbish. How did your legs hold up and get ready to run again straight away the following day?
So the worst part of getting ready for the next day was a lot of the people that are used to running outdoors had outdoor shoes. So the bottoms of my feet had bruises and they were purple and it was swollen. Like I was having trouble just like walking. I was tensed up anyways, like my hips. And the worst part about the run was not the climbs, but it was the descents. I was so physically done that my quads could not control my speed anymore. I could not slow myself down. I was literally falling. So at that stage, my quads were toast. There was nothing left. And my feet were bruised. I had stone bruises. I actually thought waking up, I was like, man, I feel good, other than my feet really hurting. I wasn't really sore. I just didn't realize how fatigued I was. And the vertical 300, I thought it was a full mile because I think it's 300 meters in vertical change, it wearing a 20-pound weighted vest for guys and a 14-pound for girls. And in this instance, I'm going into this event because it's these kind of events that I usually excel in. So I'm thinking to myself, with the Spartan Mile directly into the next event, which is DECA Heavy, I'm like, I'm going to go win 2 events because these are my wheelhouse. This is exactly, I'm like, yes. And then they say, runners on the line, and all both males and females are running together. And they're like, ready, go. And I take 10 strides and I say, oh boy. This isn't good. And because, you know, I'll do like elevation mask, stadium runs, like stair steps through collegiate football stadiums, wearing vests, wearing minimalist shoes, going sometimes an hour plus. This is my jam. Like, I'm going to do this. And I'm talking, I think I walked. I tried to lift my feet and go. They just would not physically lift and go. I mean, it's almost like a cartoon where you have to like lift your leg to move to the next step. And that's what I was doing on the side of a mountain. At that stage, I knew my body and my brain and my nervous system were just shot.
Yeah.
Because I got to the top and I'm thinking, wow, like I thought I was going to win this event. And I'm like, middle of the pack at best.
And what was it like on the trail too? Because watching the Spartan Games YouTube video, it was a very tight, and all the athletes, both men and women, were all released in one hit. And that's 24 athletes all running in unison up this hill. What were some of the challenges there to overcome?
I think we're also forgetting that night after we finished the marathon run, or like the 6 hour max distance, it got really cold and it poured that entire night. And it poured that whole next morning. And it is dumping on us really cold rain. So we're running up a hill where it's a really narrow trail. And at this point, it's like a muddy, narrow trail. Or this is part of what Joe has had people do, is he's basically taken stones and made his own set of steps to go to the top of the mountain. So you can choose to either run on slippery, wet rocks up a hill, or you can try and run up a muddy, cold trail, because they're right next to each other. You have the choice. Do I step on the step or do I step on the trail? And it's just pouring and miserable. They, at the top, they actually had like ponchos for everybody just to cover yourselves to try and hold body heat, because we were freezing and everyone's trying to get up the mountain as fast as they can. Most people don't realize you have to walk a mile back down.
Yeah, there's no chairlift, is there?
No, and you still have your weighted vest. You still have your bag. You still have got your clothes. You got to then carry everything back down the mountain. So if it takes you 12, 15 minutes to get up the mountain and you're going fast, how long do you think it's going to take to get back down? So it took another like 45 minutes to get back to the bottom of the mountain, because you're like holding onto trees so you don't fall down.
And it would still be slippery as well, because the rain's still bucketing down on all the athletes.
It's still pouring on us.
How did that affect your preparation moving into event 9, which was Deca heavy, similar to the Deca event from day 2, but the weight was just significantly heavier. Did you have to do anything to prepare your body, given how it was feeling, for this more functional event, which is probably more in your wheelhouse with your CrossFit background?
At that stage, I think everyone's preparation is, can somebody please give me a cup of coffee, a shot of adrenaline, and a punch in the face just to wake back up? There really wasn't a whole lot of preparation, at least on my end. And this is where it got maybe a little frustrating, because they did want to crown the fittest, still arbitrary, whatever you want to look at, but they considered a heavy deadlift at 225 pounds or 102 kilos. So in that instance, no. If you go to the CrossFit Games, like if you're a male and you're not pulling 400 plus pounds off the ground, you're not even competing. That became a little tough to be like, this is what you guys consider heavy. But at the same time, they're going to say, well, why can't you run faster? Or why can't you ride a bike? I understand they're trying to do as much as they can, but, you know,
and it
really
was a safety consideration too, right? Like if someone's not deadlifted before.
Well, and at that stage too, though, you have the option of skipping it.
Mm.
So you do have the option of skipping it at a penalty. But if you're going to choose to skip it and have a penalty, I think then the penalty becomes a larger penalty and you make it heavier. But it is very similar to the original DECA, like you said. It is heavier and the cardiovascular portions are shorter. So instead of like on the assault bike having to bike 25 calories in a station, the assault bike was only 15 calories.
I noticed on video, there were a few athletes that had never deadlifted before, and you're actually in the background, like stepping back into your coaching role and giving them advice around how they might approach it. Can you tell me a little bit about like some of the advice that you were giving to the athletes that had never done that before? Because a deadlift, if you've not done it, can be a very difficult and dangerous exercise.
Of course. So I think that was my opportunity to try and give back to those that had offered me some advice on maybe some of the mountain biking or some of the obstacles. We all tried to help each other as much as we could. But what I tried to do is simplify the lift for them and say, if you do choose that you want to attempt this, this is how I would do it. But I think if you actually went and watched, I even told them, hey, a lot of you guys have professional careers away from this. If you choose that this is not the right decision for you, don't lift it. Don't try it. But if you do choose, I would say, here's the most simple way to look at this. Stand very tall, put the bar right over top of your shoelaces, put your hands down on your knees, and try and keep a neutral spine in your back. So push your hips back, hands on your knees, just like you're trying to watch a game and trying to get in somewhat of a ready position. From that position, drop your hips and reach your hands for the bar. All I want you to do is reverse that. They're just very simple cues, not even weight room cues, just literally life cues, and try and give them the correct positions other than saying, hey, anteriorly tilt your pelvis, push your hips back, keep a vertical shin, keep your chest up, reach your hands down. Yeah, you want people to think as little as possible and relate things back to life as best you can.
You finished that event in fourth despite a nasty fall from a wet pull-up bar outside,
yeah,
giving you a sixth place overall moving into the final event. And event 10 was the sequel to the original opening event, the Spartan Cross. And it was a faster 2.5 kilometer Spartan Cross that had 27 obstacles. Standing on the starting line there, what was going through your mind at that time?
Knowing at that stage, I'm standing on the start line, knowing that if I've got any training under my belt, I'm competing for podium spots, if not winning. I feel that in my heart. But I know I'm not there, and I'm truly thankful for the opportunity. These are the things going through my mind on the start line. And then I have to think to myself, like, hey, you can't just take this away from yourself. Like, I also have to give credit to all the people that are very good at this stage in their life and the work that they've put in and the sacrifices that these people have made in their own lives. Some of these people are literally living in vans just so that they can compete, because they don't want to use their resources or use things for luxuries. All they're focused on is training. And I have to tip my hat to those people because of how impressed I am at the sacrifices that these people have made to be good at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So then I'm like, you know what? I just don't want to get in the way. I'm going to give my best effort, lay it out on the table, and know that I can look myself in the mirror and gave everything I could, irregardless of where things played out. But I also don't want to get in the way of the people that are ultimately competing for that top spot. We all agreed on the start line that if you were not competing to be in the money, which was the top five or top six, so kind of like I was included in that. But I basically said, hey, if you're not in the top three or four, like competing for the podium spots, let those guys go first. Let them line up on the line first. Go, and then we all can just do whatever we're going to do from there. So people don't know that we actually, if you look at the last event, we made sure that Josiah, Ryan Kent, Hunter McIntyre, ultimately the winner at Ryan Atkins, like all of those guys, basically we let them take off to the wall first, and everybody else, we just let it play out as it could so that they could ultimately go compete for the top spots.
You placed sixth overall with only 72 hours to prepare. Looking back, what is it that you appreciate most about the entire experience?
To be given an opportunity to compete on that platform with some of the world's elite, knowing that I didn't necessarily think I deserved that spot at this stage in my life. So I feel I got lucky and that it came back around. And if I could wrap it up, I was honored, humbled, excited, disappointed, and embarrassed all at the same time.
So looking to the future then, what's next for Herman Demick?
I think, like I mentioned to begin this whole process is, you know, I have taken a promotional role on our surgical team, and it does require quite a bit of time being in the operating room, being on the road, and how I can best manage my time to be the best husband and father that I can be. And then at the same time, we continue to grow 3D Performance. We continue to make sure that people know that what we do is tie together science, application, and real world experience. Because the better we can relate and empathize with our athletes on whatever front that looks like, the better buy-in we're going to get and the more apt to them following our programs the other 22 hours of the day when they're not with us.
Finally, where can people learn more about you and 3D performance training?
So it's going to be our website, which is www.3dperformancetraining.com. Although that website will soon be evolving, it'll still remain the same website, but we are going to be doing an updated version of our page. The easiest way and the page that we're going to post to most often is our Instagram page, which is 3D underscore performance. That's 3D underscore performance. That's both our Twitter handle and our Instagram handle. You follow us on Facebook, but again, our Instagram is probably going to be the most common. And I would invite anybody who's listening to this, send us a DM, tell us things that you want to hear about. That's one of the things that we really like to do is educate people. So if we have specific questions, we like to answer those questions for a large variety of people. If somebody might ask a question, you know, that might relate to a specific sport athlete, whether it's baseball or tennis or soccer or track and field or football, whatever that looks like, or somebody might simply ask us something about why we use metabolic profiling to better adjust our programs for our CrossFit athletes or our fitness athletes.
Is there anyone that you'd like to shout out to before we wrap up this episode as well?
I think there's too many people to really mention as a shout out here, but what I would say is anybody who is listening, remember, if you get an opportunity in life to do something, it's not because you alone created that opportunity. In my instance, and I've talked about this on the Spartan Games, I was able to pursue that competition because my family, my wife, my mom, my dad, my in-laws, my kids supported me to do that. My coaches supported me to do that. My manager at the time on my full-time job gave me his blessing to take some vacation days to go participate in this. So I would say if you're listening to this, don't ever think that you're doing something alone. Make sure that you thank the people around you for the support that they've given you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Herman. We'll wrap the show with that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. And that brings us to the end of episode 9, behind the scenes of the Spartan Games with Herman Demick. If you like this special 4-part series, you can follow Herman on Instagram at 3D underscore performance and find out more info about 3D, Herman, and his training philosophy at 3dperformancetraining.com. Until next time, my name is Mike and this is The Goods. Thank you for listening.